The following is a first Marine aircraft wing taped historical interview. The interview is Major Kenneth R. Buskey, 078265, United States Marine Corps. He is the S-2 officer and squadron pilot of VMO-6, Prof. Mag 39, Quang Tri Republic of Vietnam. The interviewer is Staff Sergeant Paul G. Custard, 1867466, United States Marine Corps. This interview takes place at Quang Tri in Republic of Vietnam on 24 October 1968. The subject of this interview is 01 participation in the 3rd MAR DFT AOR. The events described in this interview occurred during the period 20 January 1968 through October 1968. This interview is classified secret and downgraded by higher authority.
My name is Kenneth R. Buskey, Major, United States Marine Corps, as previously listed by the interviewer. And I chose the period 20 January 1968 through October, as that's the period I feel that the O-1s were really engaged in doing their best work. Although the detachment existed prior to that, the period I'd like to cover was during the caisson operation and thereafter. During this period, from about the end of September until January, the O-1 detachment was commanded by Lieutenant Colonel W.C. Anderson. And as a side note, just a few of the things that Colonel Anderson did is make a connection with the USO, Special Services, and various other activities in the United States, who sent gifts, presents, books, what have you, which the O-1 pilots wrapped up in with tape and made several drops. As a matter of fact, some of the troops in the field, small recon units, or those up in the hills, had a complete Christmas with Christmas trees contributed by people from some of the Boy Scouts from California. Dropped candy and shaving gear and stationery, what have you. And we had many comments out of the field, including one particular boy up on a DMZ, in which case he sent us a letter. He says, "I want to thank you very much." He says, "Due to you, I have been evacuated to the States with a broken arm." As it was, he had tried to catch one of the bundles of magazines which we tossed out, which was our greatest concern, that they shouldn't attempt to catch him while in the air. I believe he had a broken arm and a couple cracked ribs or something like that. I thought that was quite humorous. We had a small detachment up in Dong Ha operating with a couple planes, a couple pilots operating along the DMZ, selecting targets of opportunity, trying to halt the infiltration to the south. And in January, we got a call to send a pilot or two out to Quezon with aircraft. The indications were that there was a buildup in this area. So what it entailed was, during this period in January, as the monsoon season was here, pilots would have to fly down Highway 9 using Highway 9 for guidance, underneath the weather, primarily, down the valleys to get up to the Quezon area and then go about their business out there on Quezon. Initially, we put in a strong bid to make this a two-ship mission, as the area that the pilot was flying over was triple canopy. And if the O-1 ever went down out there, of course, without any helicopter assistance, the pilot was on his own. He's lost. And radio communication was poor at best, so that no one would even know when he went down or where he went down, until he didn't come back and land at the end of a 3 to 4 hour period. Of course, on 20 January, the NVA chose to attack Quezon Combat Base and blow the ammo dump, and attacked in earnest with, I believe it was somewhere in the neighborhood of 2 to 3 divisions. At that time, we got a rush call to get our aircraft out there. Initially, it was 3 aircraft on station all day. We didn't have that many aircraft available, as the entire O-1 inventory, Marine O-1 inventory in Vietnam was owned by the O-1 detachment. And I believe we had a total of 6 or 7 birds that were flyable, 6 birds that were flyable. So we worked out there with 3 aircraft, and what would happen was we'd launch 3 aircraft, check in with the mini desk, what they had out there then, which was the 26 Marines. And the 1-4 out there did an outstanding job of coordinating air and artillery and ourselves. Each one of us was assigned a sector, just according to the terrain around Quezon, a northern sector, a western sector, and a southern sector. And a 101 worked in each of these areas. It was arranged amongst the pilots that no two aircraft would be on a deck at the same time for refueling. As we landed at Quezon and refueled and re-rocketed, we'd have one plane captain go out there, and he had a 5-gallon can of oil, and he'd meet the aircraft as they landed on a deck. The pilots would taxi up, jump up in the wings, and fuel the aircraft. Then they'd have to taxi down to the revetments, where the plane captain would aid us in putting in oil and re-rocketing the aircraft, and we'd take off again. And pilots have flown up there as anywhere from 7 to 10 hours a day, the O-1s. And of course, at night, we always took our aircraft back to Dong Ha. They wanted us to leave our aircraft up at Quezon, and we tried to veto this from the simple fact that the aircraft that were left up there, the helicopters, were getting shot up by rockets, mortars, and artillery, and incurring damages, which with our small force of 3 or 4 O-1s, we couldn't take. A loss of one, it was 25% of what we had. And the very next day, approximately a week later, Colonel Anderson got the word to shift all his assets up to Dong Ha, which we would support Quezon. The pilots flew out there daily, inflicting damage upon mortar crews, the machine gun pits, and at that particular time, there were numerous NVA in the open. The reason Quezon is still there today, or was never defeated, was through the tremendous amount of air power that was brought to bear on the enemy. Contrary to the article which appeared in Newsweek on approximately, I believe it was the first week in March, it was a reporter got together with the O-2s that were flying up there and said that the O-2s saved the day at Quezon. Well, at the particular time, the O-2s were flying outside a 10-mile radius of Quezon, and the O-1s worked in close to the field. I believe that the... throughout the entire Quezon period, the O-1s flew out there until it was finally evacuated, and even after it was evacuated, we still managed to go out there down the valley and find suitable targets of opportunity. Some of the notable things that the O-1 detachment did find up there is they found and destroyed several PT-76 tanks around the Long Bay area, caught some of them that were retiring from the attack on Long Bay. They discovered, I believe, 8 to 10 37-millimeter gun emplacements just south of... southwest of Quezon Village, which the enemy had moved in, and they caught them the first day that they put the guns in. They had seen the pits and everything dug and camouflaged and watched them the first day the guns came in. They called in air support on those, which would have seriously affected the resupply and the medevac capability of Quezon Combat Base itself. They also managed to go across the border, were sent across the border, Laotian border, behind Khor Rock to find and call air on various 152 and 130-millimeter guns, which were back there bombarding the Quezon Combat Base. During this time, the pilots themselves had to subject themselves to many 37-millimeter sites located along the river in Laos, not to even mention the ones that were found near the base, which they destroyed. The NVA never made another serious attempt to move 37-millimeter within that close proximity to Quezon Combat Base again. The pilots who went behind Khor Rock, as I explained, had to subject themselves to 37-millimeter fire, and fortunately, none of them were shot down. We have incurred a few losses in the O-1s. Many of the planes were hit, which were rapidly patched and maintained by an excellent maintenance organization, which we had at that time, which was commanded, well, Lieutenant Waite was the maintenance officer, but the real wills of it were Master Sergeant Horsford and a small crew of Lance Corporals, Corporals, and Sergeants, which he had to maintain our aircraft. did an excellent job of maintaining and keeping our capability up every day. As I said, there are a number of aircraft hit. Fortunately, in the Merino 1 detachment, we've only had two pilots seriously injured. One was on the DMZ, who was shot with a 50 caliber round, and one was a crash at Quezon, in which case the pilot had been hit with mortars on takeoff just after he got airborne. Lieutenant Pennell, who was wounded and medevac back to the States. Around Quezon base itself, after they found out that they couldn't install the 37 millimeters, they made repeated attacks with 12.7 machine guns and rocket launchers, in which case many, many sites were found and knocked out by the use of fixed-wing ordnance directed by the fingerprints in the 01 detachment. I think history will prove me right. If anybody reads about the history of DNBN Phul, you'll see that the NVA used a similar pattern at Quezon as they had at DNBN Phul by moving in their artillery and rockets and then protecting their artillery and rockets with 37 millimeter and 12.7 machine guns to prevent air power from destroying them. In this particular case, it didn't work out for them due to the tremendous amount of ordnance brought to bear upon them. I'd like to go into a little bit of why I say fingerprint pilots. Now, originally, the 01 detachment was a part of HAM 16, and HAM 16 call sign was fingerprint. We assume the call signs and the numbers being 20s, normally for field grade officers, 30s, 40s, and 50s for the company grade. And each pilot was given a number, which was to become his number for his entire period in the detachment. They have tried to, I believe they've made attempts or made suggestions that we change that, seeing as how we're not in HAM 16 anymore, but had been transferred to VMO 2, and then from VMO 2 to VMO 6. And we tried to hold on to it due to the fact that when we were given this number, we were told it was a personal identification. So that if you talk to anybody, any correspondence, any write-ups or what have you, it was always a fingerprint and your number following. And it was a personal identification rather than a squadron call sign. Yeah. I talked primarily about a lot of the stuff that happened in January and February and March. But even after this time, Quezon Combat Base was still up there and still being threatened. I believe that during this period after that, that would be, I'd say around April through July, I think the KBAs attributed to the air and artillery, which the O1s controlled, is somewhere in the neighborhood of 600 or 700 NVA killed, not to mention bunkers, trenches, machine gun nests, mortar crews, and rocket positions that have been destroyed in numerous secondaries. I believe that can be found in the write-up for the Meritorious Unit Commendation. The 01 detachment also got the Presidential Unit Citation, which was issued to the 26 Marines, and I believe was the only aviation unit listed as a whole unit to receive the PUC for that period up there at Quezon. Any problems which we had over here in Vietnam with the O-1s, I believe, boiled down to being fragged, receiving a regular frag for a mission just as any other aviation unit in Vietnam does, and coordination with the DASC while airborne. We did finally solve this problem. It wasn't until just about a month and a half ago, from January through approximately the end of July or August, we operated wrote our own schedule. We just went out there and relieved on station. There was no frag telling us what time to go or what time to come home, just covered during the daytime. Some of the improvement of any equipment right now, the Marine Corps saw fit to give us the 01 Charlie, which is an increased horsepower version. The old 01 Charlie, we have a fuel injected engine on it, 300 horsepower, which gives us a compatible performance with the situations that you involve yourself in, such as going down low to check out the enemy and getting shot at. Previously in the 01 Golf, you had to sit there for 2 minutes to get back up to 1,000 to 1,200 feet out of range or out of effective range of a small arms fire, in which case now is just a matter of seconds with the newer engine. On the 01 Charlie, though, that we have now, we only have one Fox Mike radio, which I feel is not really good for the mission. In the Gulfs, we have two Fox Mike radios, in which case, when we have troops in contact, we can talk to the fixed wing with the UHF, we can talk with the ground people with one Fox Mike, and we can talk with the artillery. We'll probably adjust artillery with the other Fox Mike, and we can do this all at the same time with the help of our AO in the back seat. And another item I might list, not aircraft equipment, but I've found that for quite some time they had an argument here. Letters were written trying to get the M16 for use in the cockpit as pilot protection in the event you went down. And we finally had to get the M16 from the Air Force. I don't believe the Marine Corps owned any at that time is the reason we couldn't get them. And for an idea here is I think the pilots ought to be equipped with the, I believe it's the CAR-16, which is the folding stock or short stock version of the M16 of the shortened barrel, very light, easily handled in the cockpit. And once you went down, you could get it out of the cockpit with sufficient ammunition to defend yourself until either picked up by helicopter or continued on your way evading. As far as personal equipment, I think that the new survival radio we have that they've just issued is outstanding. I realize it's quite an expensive piece of gear. It's an outstanding survival radio. The equipment that we carry in the aircraft is a bullet bouncer. We call it the chest plate with a survival radio and a little pocket on that. Standard 38 revolver, your survival kit. And we also, as I mentioned, carry M16s with a bandolier ammunition. We've had several crashes out in the field due to engine failure or around through the fuel lines or around through the oil pan, in which case all pilots have landed the aircraft, gotten out of the aircraft, and either been picked up shortly by helicopter or been protected. They crashed within friendly lines or were protected by friendly crews. As I said before, we have not lost a pilot to crash or enemy fire. As far as my ideas on the O-1s, I realized that I pretty died in the wool. I'm pretty stuck on the O-1 because I've flown it for so many hours, but I do not feel that it should be phased out of the Marine Corps. And I think that you'll find many, many other people, both in the air wing and especially in the division, who don't want to lose the O-1 or its capabilities. I believe that the OV-10 is a step in the right direction, but I don't believe that it's the answer all to the Marine Corps' needs in air observation. As we found out with the O-1, we can stay right over the friendly troops, keep abreast of the situation. We can handle several different radio duties at the same time, call in air up to within, we have run air to within 10 to 30 meters of troops, napalm primarily. And I believe we can keep closer to the ground unit involved instead of going by at a higher rate of speed. I'm not just making this report off my hat, top of my head, as I have spent approximately 10 to 12 hours in the back seat of the OV-10, checking out the pilots up here in Northern I Corps on the area. As I said, the OV-10 is a step in the right direction. It carries the firepower so that if you do see a target on the road or in the countryside, which does not warrant a flight of air, you can engage it immediately and not have to sit there with an M16 poked out the window, which we have done in the past with the O-1. Some of the disadvantages to the O-1 are its vulnerability to any aircraft fire. In which case, as I said before, we've been most fortunate in not having warbirds shot down. Just as this is a disadvantage, we also have an advantage there. In most cases, we found documents to support this. The NVA have been instructed not to fire at the O-1 aircraft unless they're positive they can bring it down. They are not near a large unit or not near their CP. And a lot of the times they won't fire unless they really think they've been found out, they've really been seen. So in that respect, we enjoy a little bit less vulnerability to any aircraft fire. But as I said, once they determine that you have seen them and certain requirements are met, they will shoot, as testified to by the broken hearts, which we paint on the side of the fuselage of the aircraft every time it's been hit. I believe the max number of holes for an EO-1 over here since in this last 10-month period has been 9 AK-47 rounds. Most rounds impacting in the tail section or after the cockpit. In conclusion, I'd like to add a recommendation that the O-1 should be formed up in a detachment and kept as a detachment rather than the integral part of a VMO squadron. I think we could have it as a O-1 detachment of the HAM squadron of the group wherever they're stationed, and operate in that respect with a lieutenant colonel or major as OIC. It was found to be a very suitable arrangement working with HAMs, and I really saw no reason to change it.